What shall we look into? Anyone have something particular they'd like to look into? Particular subjects or areas of interest?
The dissolution of the sense of self.
Okay. It would be good to put it as the dissolution of the apparent sense of self.
Right.
Actually, we might be able to do something that would be interesting experientially with that very theme. You know, it's a kind of a game of make-believe. You inherit a set of ideas and beliefs and notions about life, about yourself. If you really think about, like, where do my thoughts come from? Where do my perceptions come from? And part of the answer to that is they come from what you learned. They come from what you've been exposed to. They come from what you've been taught. And if you were taught something different, then you would have probably followed that. And your thoughts and perceptions and so forth would have lined up with that. So it's interesting to pause and go, what exactly have I been taught? Here's one. I was taught that I'm a man. I was taught that. I was taught my name is Paul. I was taught these are the things that are good to do, these are the things that are not good to do. I was taught that other people are out there and I'm in here. You, Paul, boy, man, Caucasian, etc., etc., are in there. Nobody ever showed me who he is. They just labeled me with these concepts. Fair enough? No one showed me what a Paul is, unless they said, well, that Paul over there, that's the kind of Paul you want to be. Be like Paul McCartney. That didn't happen. Yeah.
Are there places or cultures or peoples that don't do that? Where, like, your people are born into the world and there's not this, you're in there and we're out there from the beginning?
Yes. Yes, yes. And one can study this. You don't have to go very far. Look at the history and the present consciousness of the Aboriginal. The Aboriginals are taught something very, very different. First of all, what's left of them. I should say that. They're living in full contact with the earth and the food chain. They're eating from the full food chain. They are at times wearing no clothes. They're right out in nature. They are taught that they have kinship with all other Aboriginals. And not only that, that kinship goes to a place of teaching where they're taught to communicate telepathically over thousands of miles. So like Sean, if you were and I were Aboriginals, you could, you know, just take off now and go head over there to, you know, San Juan Islands. And you and I could hook up. And that's not a cell phone. It's not the internet. It's like we can see each other's thoughts and communicate. That's telepathically. That's a very different consciousness. Not only that we come from the dream time. If you study the Aboriginals, they have this notion of the dream time, which is the beginning of life. Very different. I mean, you could find some kind of, if you really stretch it, some correlations to Judeo-Christian teachings, but you got to work to find those correlations. It's very, very different cosmology. And therefore, there's a very different sense of self. Now, what does that mean? It means the self is much, the so-called self, is much more relational. It's much more of a tribe. It's much more of a community. And many of us, in our culture, to varying degrees at different times in our life, perhaps, really appreciate community. I mean, sometimes community gets, you know, also bad press. It's weird, you know, depending on what they're doing, you know. I ended up in a hemp fest in Eugene, Oregon. By mistake. And everybody was sort of like gathered very closely together under these tents. And it was the honoring of hemp in all forms. You know, hemp this, hemp that, hemp, lots of hemp. And I didn't really resonate. So I didn't hang out very long. I was there about an hour, you know, and I was like, okay, cool for you, great. I don't think you're my tribe. Glad I visited, though. See you later. You know, Burning Man. You know what Burning Man is? Mm-hmm. It's an amazing festival. It's wild and crazy, and sometimes people take it too far and go out into this wild place in the desert and have all these, you know, pretty interesting, eccentric activities. People are dressed up in all kinds of stuff, and then there's this big thing where they burn this structure of a man. It's huge. You know, it's been going on for a long time. Well, those are activities that, you know, when people get into those activities, whether they're taking substances or not to kind of alter their consciousness, they're interested in a different sense about things than someone maybe who's going to, you know, I wouldn't do that, you know. I'm going to just go to work and come home and watch the news, you know. And then I'll do a little exercise and then I'm going to go to bed. And then I'm going to get up and do that again. My weekends are generally pretty low-key, you know. I go to, you know, kayak a little. Church on Sunday, you know. Feels good. I don't like to get too close, you know. Some of the people hug. I just stay back a little bit, you know. I'm a distance, you know, a little touch. You know, I shake hands with the minister. That's who I am. That person's not going to Burning Man. Okay, they're just not. If you just look at the pictures of Burning Man, you might go, I'm not going to Burning Man. You might go, wow, I think I'll go to Burning Man. In fact, I think I'll go every year. There's people who do that. That's like a big, big thing. So yes, it's true. There are people in all over the place with a different sense of self. I mean, just go, well, what comes to mind? You know, so the last time I was in Europe, I was in, among other places, I was in Amsterdam. And Amsterdam, I don't know whether you know, is, if you've been there, it's an amazing place. It's very, very open. And it's not perfect. There's no Shangri-La except in your fantasy land. You know, just like there's no Wizard of Oz. Okay? It's a movie. It's a fable, right? It's a myth. But I found such a feeling of ease there. I was like, oh man, this feels so homey to me. Wherever I went, restaurant, in the street, looking at people, talking, just sitting on the bench. You know, I liked all the bicycles, that made me comfy. You know, all the bicycles seemed to have the rule of the road instead of the cars. That felt good to me. So sometimes that sense of who we think we are or feel we are can be very connected to places or other people or what other people are doing. You see, this is, I'm just talking about part of what's really going on a multiplicity of aspects, or you might say levels, I don't like that word so much, but aspects all over the place. But what's not really happening so readily is there's not a lot of people on the planet that are really intentionally, meditatively questioning the sense of self. What is the sense of self? Or if you like the perennial question, which I think is a little bit more beneficial to use if you're going to really kind of get some traction into this inquiry, is who am I? And that's a question that's been passed down, you know, for millennia. It was around before the Buddha. There were people really deeply asking that question. Which, of course, you know, does confront one with, you know, what is myself? So we talked about the five aggregates the last 2 weeks, the body, feeling, perception, thought, and consciousness, as the tangible, yeah? You can actually observe, and put your hands on the body, of course, but you can actually observe the five aggregates. And then you can actually begin to observe that which is observing the five aggregates, which is what I call awareness itself. You can actually observe awareness. And anytime anyone actually starts to observe awareness and get a sense of that, those other things that you would maybe call yourself or feel as part of yourself or believe as part of yourself actually come into question a little bit. Is that really myself? Okay, I won't rule it out as part of myself. Like, we can all agree that the body would be part of yourself, but is the body all of yourself? If somebody says the body is all of myself, okay, well then, when the body dies, what happens to you? And no one can answer that. You, now we have that word. What happens to you when the body dies? I mean, people say, you know, so-and-so died. We have no idea what it actually is. It's really interesting that we have no idea truly what it is. I mean, we have ideas, but we don't know experientially. Unless you remember past lives of having died before, and apparently some people do this. I don't always trust in myself, I think so. Sometimes they're just like, you know, making a bit of a, you know, like that's their shtick. Because I don't find that many people, honestly, who actually play around with releasing past lives. I think it's quite fine if you need to release anything. How about release this life? How about release whatever's making you weird and neurotic to yourself or anybody else here and now? Never mind any place that you think it comes from. But anyways, I've not met too many people who are apparently conscious of past lives that seem integrated in other ways, as far as I'm concerned. Eccentric would be one word. Not quite balanced would go a little further. Weird, and then it goes all the way out to the far end, deranged. But I lived in Egypt, and you were there with me. You just don't remember. But I trust the Buddha when the Buddha said, you know, in his meditation he remembered all of his past lives in great detail and could articulate them. Well, boy, you know, if you get a flash and it feels authentic of a past life, that's going to alter your sense of who you think you are. If you're contracted or locked into anything right here. If you have an out of body, which happened to me a couple times spontaneously, I didn't plan it. I used to do yoga and breathing, and I was kind of aggressive with it. I'd get up at 4 a.m. and Kundalini yoga and breathe and bend and breathe and bend all by myself. I didn't need anybody there with me. I was just going for it. And then I'd lie down, you know, in the corpse pose. You know the corpse pose? Lie down in the corpse pose. Boom, I pop right out of my body. I'm up on the ceiling. I'm looking down. I was like, huh. Guess I'm not only my body. I was like, how do I get back? As soon as I had that thought, how do I get back? I got scared. Fear came up. And it was like, I ended up back in the body. And the whole body then started flipping around, reacting, you know, with anxiety and how it looks when someone's having anxiety. I was like, whoa, that was kind of interesting. Now, there's some people go, I'm going to keep doing that. I'm going to repeat that. I'm going to study the teachings of Raymond Moody. I'm going to learn how to project at different levels. And it's like, why? And if there isn't a clear answer there, like, why are you doing that? What is that doing fundamentally for the quality of your life and the quality of the lives of others? And if it's actually directly, in my sense, connecting in a way that is helping you to be a more peaceful, harmonious, loving, contented, forgiving, generous, compassionate human being, hey, cool. If going down to the bar does it, maybe we should all head down there. But I don't see that happening, actually. I see actually the opposite happening down at the bar the last time I was there. I didn't see people becoming more compassionate. I saw people becoming more irritated. Because that's what alcohol does to you if you drink enough. It, you become irritated and inflamed. Tissue-wise. As well as mentally, emotionally. First, it's, you know, depressing. It kind of slows things down. You kind of get mellow. So, the parent cell fire, you see, inserted into this experience of living is this sense of an apparent self that's living in this form. And the funny, interesting, and profound experiment that we can all engage in is to actually look for that sense of self. Or if we made it more precise, if you are in there, if there's an I in there, or me, find it. Okay, so Sean's going right here, okay? And that means what? Okay, so now let's do that. Let's take Sean's direction. We don't have to do this thing. But we can just look in here. Look in there. If there's an I or a me in there, we ought to be able to actually see it. Not assume it, but see it, or even more than that, talk clearly about it in definitive terms. Like, I can talk pretty clearly about the bell. Let's see. The bell's got four circles on the bottom, two smaller ones, two bigger ones. We ought to be able to talk about self like that. We ought to be able to talk about the eye. Can we do that? Or are we just going to have a bunch of thoughts? Because what you're actually doing there, and it's where most people go, Sean. They don't usually go, my sense of me? Sense of self? Right there. Right there. There it is. See? It's me. I mean, kids will do this. You know, they're playing. It's having fun. What's here, Sean, and I don't mean back here, I mean up here, is the thought eye. I am Paul. That thought's right here. That thought doesn't stay just there in its influence. That thought goes in, this is Paul. Becomes a neurologically embodied phenomenon. You're right. But that thought, Sean lives up here, or Paul lives up here, is it anything more than a thought? Is it anything more than a thought? Because thoughts don't hang around, do they? Have you noticed? Can you get any thought to hang around? Have a thought and make it stay put. I mean, you could keep thinking the same thought. If you keep thinking the same thought over and over and over, you know what happens? You go kind of kooky. That's obsessive. Compulsive to think the same thought over and over and over. Gotta take out the trash. Gotta take out the trash. Gotta. Ay, 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 ay. We don't do that, most of us. So just because the thought is up here in the forebrain, does that mean there's somebody actually in there other than a thought? See, the important thing about this, and I think we could look at this angle now, is that let's say you, so to speak, or anybody, is having some difficulty with some experience. Maybe some feelings, maybe some... It could be body experience, bodily discomfort. Could be emotion. Could be a way that they're actually viewing something, you know. They're viewing something, you know, like, for example, it's going on politically and they're getting very disturbed about the other side's views. You know, they have a view, an opinion. Anything that you're actually troubled by. And we'll include in this, like, what's going on in the world out there or other people. How do you come to peace with something that you're conflicted about? How do we do that as humans? Well, sometimes we go in there and we investigate it, we analyze it, we kind of pull it apart. Does this make sense? We talk to other people, we might rationalize. We do a number of different things, including like, okay, there's emotion in there. We look at the emotion, see if we can relax around the emotion, get a session of body work. go to sleep, avoid it, you know, all kinds of different strategies. And lo and behold, nothing lasts, and even chronic things don't last. They just last longer than acute things. Things change. It might take a long time. It didn't take Trump long at all to become a Republican. He was a Democrat just a few years ago. You study his political moves. He just shifted it over because it was convenient. It fits the current state, you know, what he's trying to do. Next thing you know, he'll be a libertarian. Or dead if he stays in Mexico much longer. He's not welcome there, and he decided to go visit. I wouldn't have wanted to do that. So you also can see that there's human beings who have super strong identity. It's often egoic identity, self-identity, like this is who I am and don't with me. You know, and there's other people who are just, you know, don't have a lot of identity, they don't have a lot of agency, they might even be very feeble. Why is that? Different degrees of investment. Different degrees of emotional investment in charge about what? Who they think they are, what they think's true. Regardless of where you come from and what your cultural background and conditioning is, if you look into the question of who am I, or as we were doing a moment ago, where am I? The answer to that question for everybody is not words. It's the absence of words. It's space. It's nothing. There's nothing tangible there except the thought that comes and goes. I am, or I. Before you get I am, you have I. Then you get I am, and then it goes Paul, Ralph, boy, girl, good, bad, cute, ugly, big, small, fat, stupid, I am, fill it in. Smart. And then it doesn't just go there, it goes to other people. They are these things too. But it starts with the I am. Before we go, you are. In our developing brain. Anybody else want to weigh in on where the I is?
A lot of them.
There's a lot of them?
There's a lot of them.
Okay, where are they though?
Embodied in this.
Alright.
Yeah.
And does it seem to you that they come from here and then become embodied? Is this embodiment of I preceded by thought?
Sometimes.
And then
sometimes it seems purely reactive.
Purely reactive?
Yeah. Okay. It's coming from external stimuli.
Alright. Like, give me an example. Like, what would be a form of external stimuli that would be a good example of that?
Feeling of the cushion.
Okay.
I'm sitting on it.
Oh, yeah. Okay, simple. Like, just the feeling of the cushion. This is my butt. I'm sitting.
Yeah, and here.
Okay, so you notice how most people, other than saying, you know, these are my socks, they're not yours, Rob. Don't touch my socks. The sense of self doesn't extend beyond the skin unless you project it into the object. And you wouldn't say, this is me. You just say, this is mine. You wouldn't say, my sock is part of me. Well, there's people who get into this sometimes. They go, the flowers are part of me. Have you ever hugged a tree? It's part of us. You know, there's these people. They're sweet, usually. They're very gentle. Feel this. We're all one. You can even do it with cars. Just be soft when you touch because they're very hard at first. You know, but that's not phony ultimately because everything is interconnected. It's a little bit of a stretch to kind of feel oneness, you know, with a Ford.
People do that with animals. A lot.
Oh, animals, yes, all the time. Because in a way, the animals are already sort of in a space, it seems, of connectivity and openness and not self, Sean. Not self. You ask the dog, who are you? I mean, first of all, you can talk to dogs and they pick up on stuff, but they're not going to answer that question with, well, let me meditate on that. Hang on. They're the living expression of what they are. They don't have to prove it. And it doesn't seem to me like they're living in a lot of mental, emotional conditioning, and yet their brains are organized and they do seem to have very, very sensitive nature. They feel. They don't hold on to things unless they're traumatized a lot, and then they are scarred by that. Usually humans that do that to them.
Because wild animals really are more that way that you're describing.
That's right. The domesticated animals, you know, they do take on some of our characteristics, some, but nowhere near what we do, because you never hardly ever see a healthy dog with a mood disorder. I mean, you can get up in the morning, you know, and you're like, oh, jeez. And they're just like, wait, damn, like, I had a dog for a while, 16 years, you know. She was interesting. She had chow hound mix. And the hound in her made her always want to escape. She never wanted to not escape. And then she'd escape, and then she'd, you know, play with being escaped in the neighborhood. And, you know, take our time to catch her. You know, we catch her finally. Get the neighbors to catch her. You know the story. And she never, ever, ever was unhappy if you came to her in the morning or the night. If you came to her, she was never, ever unhappy until she got canine cognitive disorder, which is a form of dementia that dogs get. And then she wasn't the same. She would literally almost walk into the wall, you know, because she lost her equilibrium as she declined. So there isn't any self to dissolve, because there never was a self in the first place. But yet, what we're talking about here is the appearance of a self. And why is this important? Because if you consider that being truly awake is the gift of being a human being. And being truly awake means that out of that sense of being awake comes the very, very best, the very, very most wholesome, most cherished, if you like, you could put the word valuable, qualities of the human. Human beings who are spontaneously kind, spontaneously compassionate, spontaneously forgiving, that's an important one, deep one. Those are the most awake beings in our world. Why? Because they're not selfish. They're not holding on to themselves or how things should be. You can't do that if you forgive. Just think about somebody who really hurt you. Really hurt you. They didn't just hurt you a little bit. Really hurt you. Maybe they intentionally tried to hurt you. That's tough. And notice, if you have ever had this experience, how the mind can invest in what we could call righteous judgment, righteous anger, righteous rage, to the point where people, very sane, very healthy, successful people in walks of life, will want to kill another person. Want to kill him. The governor of Maine recently wanted to kill, he wanted to have a Russian roulette with this other person in the political thing up there, and then he started apologizing for it. I mean, this is completely out of control. And he says, I'm never going to talk to the press again. Actually, I don't think you should ever talk to anybody again for a while. You should be quarantined and not allowed to talk. You need a long period of meditation and silence. Don't ask the question, who am I yet? Just see if you can get a handle on your feelings, dude, because you're out of control. And that's kind of weird to think about. You're the governor of a state. I mean, it's not that weird these days.
Yeah.
Maybe it's becoming commonplace.
We live in Florida, you know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, imagine someone like the Dalai Lama, Who is the spiritual head of Tibet? Again, what's left of it? Imagine him being the leader of a country. I mean, Martin Luther King wasn't perfect, you know. But imagine Martin Luther King being the head of this country, you know, politically. Mahatma Gandhi was in a very important position for a while, and then he got shot. Boom, gone. The most wholesome human beings, the healthiest human beings, they're not even in the news. Isn't that interesting? It's not sensational. It's not attractive enough to be nobody, to not have selfishness. And we do have these exceptions, you know. Now Jimmy Carter's getting a whole lot of attention, and he's getting attention for the good things he did, not the so-called bad things he did. And he didn't do too many bad things, it seems. But, you know, how it goes, history digs things up. He wasn't perfect. Seems to be a very peaceful peanut farmer who became the president. Look at what he's doing now. How's he spending his time? Pretty wholesome, pretty kind, pretty unselfish. So it turns out that the people who are embodying and expressing some of the most wholesome qualities are also the least selfish people, because they don't identify with the I am consciousness. I am as much or at all. And then if you move into the spiritual area, you move into the specifics of spirituality, you particularly move into Eastern, you particularly move into Indian spirituality, Buddhism and Hinduism in particular, Taoism and Confucianism, and you start to see something very, very consistent. That these teachings, these groups of people, specifically and intentionally and systematically, resolve the question, they answer the question, who am I? And it's weird because in India you find, even today, tremendous, tremendous expressions of enlightenment and enlightened living, and all kinds of charlatanism, all kinds of fake, all kinds of blur, all kinds of ignorance, all kinds of poverty, all kinds of tragedy, and it's right out there. Right out there.
Well, couldn't you say that the face is a real manifestation of whatever it is that we are psychologically?
And spiritually.
And spiritually.
Yes. Have a good night. See if you can figure out who you are before bed. Yes, it isn't just the personality and the emotional state. And even like if you can see sometimes when people are very active in thinking, you'll see it all over their face. You see their face adjusting and contorting. Then if you look a little bit in there, and you start going with the poetic rendition of, you know, the eyes are the window of the soul. Okay. Most people have no idea what the soul is unless they've heard a teaching on the soul and now they've adapted an ideation. The idea that there's a soul that moves from lifetime to lifetime, that reincarnates. Kind of a Judeo-Christian belief. Where's the soul? I had a guy that I was doing counseling with in California. Really, really disturbed. Very interesting, very smart guy. Gay, really conflicted about his sexuality. Never looked me in the eye. Never looked me in the eye. He looked down a lot. He'd go like this a lot. He talked like that. He was from Australia, I believe. Not that that matters. He was British underneath that. And he used to talk about this dresser. He was very unusual, and he was also very poor. But he had enough money for counseling with an intern, which was like $20 an hour. And I was learning how to do that stuff. And I liked him. I mean, I just liked him a lot. I felt very connected to him. I felt his suffering, and you know, His mother was schizophrenic, and she'd been hospitalized when he was like 5. She just disappeared. This is in the UK. She just disappeared. She was suddenly gone, and no one explained this to him. Imagine that. All of a sudden, the mother's gone, and no one says, well, she's away for a while. It's just like no explanation at all. He didn't even think to ask. He was just bewildered, and it just went on. Father never told him. Siblings never said a word. All of a sudden, she's gone. Now, this happens in families sometimes. Something really different or tragic happens, and we're not going to talk about it. We're not going to talk about it. That really messes people up. So here we are, years later. He's probably 38, 40 years old. And what he needs to talk about is what happened to him when suddenly one day he's now like 7. His dad says, get in the car, we're going somewhere. You don't even tell him where. Get in the car, we're going. Gets in the car, they start driving. And the father goes, we're going to see your mother. What? It's like years later, after she disappeared, all of a sudden we're going to see your mother. No connection in between. They go to the mental hospital. And it's this kind of big place with a big door, you know. He describes this. He was really articulate, you know. He could describe things very, very well. And there were like these pillars and the door, and he's talking about all that. And there's a corridor, and you go in the corridor. And the father took him and had his hand on his back, and he said, go, go, go. He's pushing him from the back. And the kid was just probably a mess psychologically. And so then there was a turn in the corridor, and he said, pushed him that way. And he said, go, go, go to that chair. He just pushed him away. He said, go to that chair. So this is a big chair with the back, he's looking out the window, and he goes up to the chair, and he comes around the chair, and there's this woman in the chair, and he comes around to the chair, and he looks at the woman, he cannot recognize her. And the father comes up behind him, he says, that's your mother, go up to her. Go up to your mother. The mother doesn't recognize him. Can you imagine what this is doing to this boy's psyche? Well, this went on. We did some therapy, he got a little bit better around these things. But I bring him up because he talked in depth in a very sensitive way about how his soul was like, notice this now, was like the walnut that made his dresser. And he could talk about this, and it was like the way in which somebody who really knows the blues, it's in them, his soul. Something of a feeling comes through there that's profound. And after talking about this dresser and how important it was to him, he then said, I also have a cello. And he started talking about the wood in the cello and how the cello was his soul. And it was like very compelling. So is the soul like this and that? And is that the same or different than the spirit? See, these are words. And they're more difficult to get our heads around than the I, the me, the self thing, because that's been indoctrinated into us. And we believe it's here, or we believe it's here, we believe it's here. And I'm using the word apparent sense of self, because if we investigate any of these experiences, we're not going to be able to find something substantial there. And that's extremely important. You can't find a substantial sense of self in the butt. You can't find it, whether it emerges internally or it's stimulated by the external. You can't find it. And that's a very important discovery. Because what that discovery does, if you let that discovery happen, is it shifts you to some extent in terms of how you identify with other types of experiences that you could call yourself, like your body pain, your emotional states, your mental states. Why would it be beneficial to not be so identified with those things? I've already said. Because the people who are less identified with those things exhibit the qualities that we find most appealing, most attractive, in terms of how human beings behave. Isn't that interesting? You don't find somebody who's kind, compassionate, you know, caring, generous, forgiving, hoarding money. Get your hand off the counter. Don't touch the counter. It's clean. My father was neurotic, but he was also extremely generous. He used to tell people all the time, whatever is mine is yours. At one point in his life, caretakers that were taking care of a home that he was renting, and he was away doing work, caretakers who were supposed to just care of the place, mow the grass, you know, keep it up, they literally moved in. They took over the house and were living there. They were alcoholics. It was a whole family. And the state police had to be called to get him out. And I thought about that and I said, I think I know exactly why this happened. Dear old dad said, whatever's mine is yours. And they went, sounds good to us. It wasn't balanced. That generosity that he would exhibit at times would annoy the whole family because we'd go someplace and all of a sudden he's doing the whatever is mine is yours to strangers talking and we're like, can we go? I have multiplicity of memories of like being dragged around by him and he's being kind to everybody to the point where people are like, even I got this over the years from people, they're like, your dad's a bit too much. And I go, it's not a bit, it's a lot. And he meant very well, Sean, but he was not balanced. And, behind the scenes, he wouldn't like this, but he ain't here anymore. He was always on top sexually. And he controlled the money. A generous, kind, unselfish dad doesn't control the money. He manages the money. She knows what's going on. And the kids know what's going on when it's appropriate for them to know what's going on. He doesn't on it. So it turns out that that sense of self that doesn't actually exist except as a thought that gets embodied is the place where clinging arises from. And that place of clinging is the place where suffering arises from. And the chain, outcome chain, you could call it, from that point of clinging to a sense of me or I, is the whole reason why we are an effed up race to an extent. We are creating many more problems here than the dogs, cats, birds, and chickens. Not to mention the crocodiles, most of which are sleeping peacefully wherever they are for hours on end. And if you don't bug them, they don't bug you. People go after other people. They don't even have to be provoked because they can't contain their aggressive, fearful tendencies, as Freud said. Fear and aggression. But where is that coming from? See, in order to identify with those feelings strong enough to act them out, there must be somebody in here, or believed to be somebody in here, who invests in those feelings, or what those feelings are about, or what I need to do with those feelings, or what my agenda is, or what my belief is, so that I'm willing to go to that extent. Sure, particularly the non-domesticated animals, as you mentioned, are, they live out extremely aggressive. It's you know, survival of the fittest. They're eating other creatures. So are we. And even if you're a vegetarian or you're all the way out to veganism and you're trying to do breatharianism, you know, you're just breathing air. I don't want to eat any food. Go for a walk. You just killed something. I mean, right out there, you're not going to get to your car. Get to your car without killing something. Can't do it. I mean, you can't see it in many cases, and sometimes you do before you step on it and you move your foot. The Jains went to an extreme. They took, and they were white. They don't eat. They're vegetarians. They were even had a thing that was so weird to me when I heard about it. They don't eat cauliflowers for some particular reason.
Or carrots.
Some kind of,
Or carrots.
Or carrots. Do you know why?
Yeah, because you pull them up out of the ground and you disturb what's inside the ground. You kill them.
Okay. There you go. Thank you. Anyways, they put a cloth over their mouth so they wouldn't breathe anything in because they took this ahimsa, which is the Indian concept for non-harming, to the extreme. To a place of potential, you might call it, impracticality. But out at the other extreme, you got people who, I don't care about. I mean, I'll shoot anything I want. Including you, if I don't like you. It's a whole extreme, but if we track it all the way back, because whatever human being wants, whether they have a clear path to this or not, is to be happy, peaceful. And when you boil it in there, if they're not too twisted up, love and be loved. Loved and be loved. It turns out, the less there is an investment in an apparent self that actually isn't there in the way we think or believe, what's naturally here. Check it out. When you're not absorbed in your thoughts or your ideas or what you have to do or where you have to go or your memories, you're just sitting there at the breakfast table and you're just naturally open to life. Beautiful, simple things happen right there at the breakfast table. Because nothing's in the way of being naturally open, kind, loving, connected. It's okay to have the I thought. We have it many times a day. But does that mean you're what the thought says you are? And if it does mean that, what happens to all that when you die? And if somebody says, I know what happens when you die. Nothing. I say, what do you mean by that? I just said it, nothing. Can we stop and just, I'll ask one more time, what do you mean by that? All right, it's like deep sleep. Okay, how do you know? Why don't? It just makes sense. It's not investigated. My dad used to say, I'm going to heaven and there's going to be watermelon. Because he's from Iowa. He's an Iowa farm boy and they're always eating watermelons. I said, going to be a lot of them, Dad? He said, oh yeah, there'll be plenty. He'll be there too. Not until your time, son. Not until your time. Until we meet again. Like, sounds great, Dad. But can we talk about that a little bit? You don't know for sure, do you? He goes, it's my faith, son. I said, you still don't know for sure, do you, Dad? He says, my faith, son. I said, Dad, we're going round and round. You're on one gerbil wheel and I'm on the other. Can we get on the same wheel? The heck are you talking about, boy? I'm talking about Jesus and the Buddha. He goes, well, Jesus was better. I said, how do you know? He says, my faith. I said, can we get off that journey? We go on like this. He believed that Jesus had the truth. The Buddha was okay, but he didn't really have it as much. You see, and I don't need to believe that the Buddha had it and Jesus didn't, because as far as I'm concerned, they're both great. They're just different. I don't care that one was called a son of God and the other was called enlightened. It makes no difference to me. Examine the teachings and the teachings make sense. Jesus didn't say there isn't a self. Jesus didn't give any teachings on no self. It was a different kind of teaching. What was it? It was about love. It was about forgiveness. It was about do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. It was about the golden rule. It was about the kingdom of heaven. It's like a mustard seed. Whoa, deep, dude. That's really profound. What are you talking about? The kingdom of heaven is all over planet Earth. People don't see it. Only apparent few people could understand him because he was so on it. The metaphor, the parable, the way that he taught, not just what he said apparently, but how he lived. Oh, he got angry. So did the Buddha. Not very much. Look at the influence of just those two beings. Thousands of years of influence. Look how many people line up with that. Why? Because these dudes are trying to take over the country and say, I'm your man, vote for me. I'm your woman, vote for me. See, quite the opposite. So, we could come at this from a lot of different angles. This is just some angles. Instead of sitting and believing that there's a self or that there isn't a self, that there is an I or that there isn't an I, the good great news is you can investigate for yourself and see. And the good news about that in part is as you investigate who is this me or I, inevitably what you end up investigating sooner or later is awareness itself. Because if there's an I or a self in here, then awareness must be that which is observing it. Otherwise, we couldn't talk about it. Just like you said, Sean. What was it that allowed you to say the I self is up here? And the answer is awareness. Now, where is that awareness? Are you that? Is that what you are? This is quite interesting. It's quite subtle. Many people's meditation for many years, sometimes their whole lives, is absorbed in the phenomena of their experience. And the phenomena of the experience, when it gets nice and smooth and steady, the body, the feeling, the thought, the perception, the consciousness, people generally feel very, very good. Feel very peaceful. They haven't tackled the question of who am I though. What they've done is they've feng shuied the room of the body-mind process. Feels great. And all it takes is one little mosquito, not a Zika one, but a little mosquito. And a sensation arises and things are different. If the person's got a lot of equanimity, then it doesn't matter that it's a mosquito. If a person has a lot of equanimity, really a lot of equanimity, it doesn't matter whether it's Zika and it doesn't matter whether it kills the body. Because they're not identified with it. Saints, when the body gets sick, they don't have any reaction. They don't fight. True saints, true awake beings, do not have a problem with the body getting sick or the body dying. Because there is an investment in the body as what they are. Singularly, most human beings, until they grow enough, mature enough, psychologically, Derek, and spiritually, they'll be identified with their face. They'll be identified with their hair falling out. They'll be upset. Maybe they're changing it and it doesn't look right. And I mean, you know, it's fine if you're in the performing arts and you need to do these kinds of things. But when the egoic mind grabs a hold of how it has to be, then you got people trying to not age. Wrinkles. They fix it up. Nose job.
I got a question, Paul. And this is going to take a little bit to get out there appropriately, so bear with me. So we're talking about the apparent sense of self, right? And we're talking about sort of the initial question was about the dissolution of the apparent sense of self. I feel like you circled around a few minutes ago to awareness, that we're trying to say that the apparent sense of self, how does the apparent sense of self and the awareness that's happening here, there's like awareness, and so I've got like my awareness. Like your awareness is kind of like over there, and you're aware of that kind of stuff. We've got my awareness over here. How is the apparent sense of self related to, like, is it just like a confusion of words that when we say the apparent sense of self, we mean the awareness that's happening here?
What you're talking about is the same place that you said the I happens. You're saying awareness happens. Now look at this right now. Is awareness all over this room? Mm-hmm. Or not? Is awareness just here, Sean? Or is it all over the body and then perhaps also all over the room? Mm. I know the thought, I know you said the thought is up here. The I am thought, you know.
Right, like there's a speaker behind you that I am aware of the speaker sometimes, right? There's aware. I'm aware of the speaker sometimes.
Right.
Because it comes and goes. There's things inside of the speaker that I'm not really aware of until I really think about them. And I'm like, yep.
Okay, I like that. Keep going.
There's things that are there, right? There's, you know, there's some concrete underneath the floorboards that I could be aware of if I let that go there. But does it mean that awareness was there before I went there?
Okay. Now you're talking about the projection of attention.
Okay.
Attention is different than awareness. I, for example, I'm not trying to say awareness is in the back seat of your car out there. But if you think about the back seat of your car out there, okay, and you visualize the back seat of your car out there, everybody came in a car, right? So we don't have a problem talking about a car, right? Okay. Is awareness in that? Awareness sees the movement of attention, just like awareness sees thoughts.
Awareness sees the movement of attention, right.
Does that make sense?
So then awareness is here, though.
Does anybody else believe that or feel that? Is awareness here? Mm-hmm. What about right here? Is awareness more here or here? Or is it the same? We're having a hard time answering this, aren't we? This is important. This isn't like, oh, we have a problem here. No, we have an opportunity. The apparent sense of self is much easier to actually kind of play around with in terms of these kinds of questions. Where is it? What is it? When is it? Is there any time that it's not? Da 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 da. We can get some data pretty quick on that because people have strong beliefs about the self. Awareness. It's really hard to have a lot of beliefs about awareness, but there are a few. Some people will talk and they believe, my awareness is growing. I was not aware and stubbed my toe. I was completely out of it, meaning awareness. Who are you? That's consciousness now you're talking about. Most people haven't looked enough to see that consciousness and awareness are two different phenomena. That's why there's two different words. So it turns out, not just tonight, but the meditative traditions, all of them, end up investigating awareness because it's the gate to realizing who you are and who you aren't, or what you aren't. Now, why is this important? Because if you meditate upon your experience over and over and over, the best you can get from that is temporary feng shui body-mind states. Because what you're working with there is a field of conditioned phenomena that's cyclically changing, going round and round and round. It's a wheel. Now, I'm not going to introduce into that wheel another wheel called death of the body-mind process. It's a whole other kind of teaching or story, if you will. But rather, just in a lifetime of 60, 70, 80, 90, whatever number of years, could it be agreed upon now that the phenomena of this body-mind process, it's not ever the same, as I often say, but there are patterns that repeat themselves of thoughts, of feelings, of sensations, and you become very familiar with this. This is what it feels like, you know, when the body's relaxed. This is what it feels like when there's tension there. This is what it feels like when there's fear coming around. This is what it feels like when there's anger. This is what it feels like when there's satiation. This is what it feels like when it's rested. This is what it feels like when there's non-rest, etc., etc. Very familiar, right? and it goes around and around and around and around and around. So the best you could accomplish if you meditated on those, you would find a degree of tranquility amidst those and equanimity, and that's fine. But you'd be in the same room over and over and over, metaphorically. And that room would be the room of the body-mind process. As soon as you start to look at that which sees the body-mind process, not only does the body-mind process tend to like that very much, you know why? Because now it's not being messed with. It's like letting the body-mind sleep while being conscious. And we all know that the body-mind process loves to sleep. It loves it. Drinks it up. So much so that some people like that so much they do not want to wake up. I talked to a young man today. I said, "What time did you wake up this morning?" He said, "As late as possible." I said, "What time is that?" He said, "About 10. He said, "I would have stayed at least until 12 if I could." And I said, "Why is that?" He said, "It's just so comfortable to be asleep." He's avoiding being awake. Well, not awake awake, but he's avoiding some of the waking state experience. Have you ever been there?
Yeah.
Sure, sure. And then people like the waking state. It's really fun, the party. They don't want to go to sleep. Kids are like this. I don't want to go to sleep. It's clinging, but it's not a real problem. It's actually fairly funny and humorous. But until we actually take what in Zen they call the backward step, and we begin to look at awareness itself, we will be conditioned to repetitively meditate upon that which we're observing, instead of looking at the field of observation itself. So the experiment that I'd invite you to play with, you can take this home with you if you like, is whenever you're having any kind of difficulty, and instead of employing your typical strategies for dealing with that difficulty, which I named a few common ones, just notice the difficulty, don't do a thing, except see if you can notice that which is noticing the difficulty. And if you get a sense, yeah, I don't know where that is, but it's different than continuing to be focused on the experience of the difficulty. Stay there. Stay there with that which you can't actually locate. You can't find that awareness. I know you set us up here, Sean, but I think what you're saying is the I that thinks it's aware is up here. And what I'm saying is there's awareness that sees the I that apparently is up there. It's the other way around. But that awareness, you can't find it singularly in the head. You can't find it in the forebrain. In fact, wherever there's sensory experience, like the sensation of the ear, that cannot register unless there's awareness. And if I'm suddenly thinking about St. Petersburg, Russia, I'm not trying to say awareness is suddenly in St. Petersburg, Russia. What is it that allows the thought St. Petersburg, Russia to even arise? And the answer is very simple. It's awareness. Why did I stand up like that? Make a dramatic moment.
Touch your ear.
There you go, touch the ear. So what you do is you drop towards the awareness that has been observing the experience, in this case something that's troubling or difficult, and spend some moments hanging out there in that non-identified, non-local space. And then come on back and have a look at the trouble. And then come on back and tell me whether that trouble is more or less or the same. And if you find that that trouble is lessened by it not being focused on, and this is not like, I'm just going to distract myself into some other phenomena. Like, I don't want to hear that you're fighting anymore, I'm watching television. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the very simple and powerful freedom to unidentify from experience by focusing on that which is observing experience for a little bit, and then come back and look at the experience. And I think what you'll find, what most people find, they go, holy smokes, I didn't touch it, I left it alone, I in a way forgot about it, and I came back, life is better. Now you can't do this with kids that are fighting. I'm going to put my attention on awareness itself, and when I come back, you're not going to be fighting as much. You can't do this with bills, okay? I'm going to put my attention on awareness, and when I come back, the bill will be paid. It's about how the mind-body process, when identified with as yourself, becomes a more complex experience to live in and as. That's it. Good timing. The AC went off right there. Turns out that this awareness actually is absolutely unified with everything that's happening that the awareness sees. That's called pure awareness. Ordinary awareness would be like, oh yeah, going to the store now and then, I'm kind of tired, I'm going to go to bed. Yeah, I'll probably listen to a little music before I do. Oh wait, I got a call. Yeah, I'll make a note on that. Let's see. I'm going to sleep in. it's just thoughts often and some planning and sort of remembering, and body awareness is there too, and you know, if it wasn't, you wouldn't be able to drive the car or not put your hand in the door, you know, and smash it. That's there. But the awareness in ordinary day-to-day awareness is not very sharp. It's not very illuminated. What happens is that awareness has embedded in it what we call meditative awareness or mindfulness. And that's the awareness that can observe things without interfering, without judging, without comparing. Okay, when that meditative awareness wakes up, oftentimes the mind identifies with, this is my awareness. That's the I am now saying I am aware. That's a thought. See, we can definitely confirm very quickly without meditating, deeply investigating, or talking to anybody else that we truly don't. We truly don't, in truth, own anything. Not even the body. At best, you could say, you know, it's a joke, you're renting it. Why? Because nothing is permanent, nothing lasts. Therefore, there is no ownership. There's no possessibility. Possession is a make-believe conventional phenomenon that keeps me out of your car and keeps you out of mine. Right? So I don't walk over and just take your guitar and think it's mine. You know, and you don't come into my house and start sleeping in my bed and say, what? There's no self, right? I happen to like your bed, your house. Well, by the way, you know, I just put my name on your bank account and crossed yours off. Big deal. You know, it'd be funny if we lived in a world like that where people could just make stuff like that. It's like, because you know, that's what they try to do with bicycles in certain places. They put all the bicycles out there, and if you're not careful, all the bicycles get stolen. You know, you can ride bicycles, you got to lock them up in places where people will steal them. Maybe in different towns like Portland, you know, I've been there. All these bicycles are out there, and you know, they got a system where you can ride a bike from one place to another, and you put it on the rack and lock it. And it kind of works until the thieves figure out how to steal them. We just can't be trusted with openness. We're just not ready for it. You know, so we do it in small degrees, in places where, you know, we feel we can pull that off collectively. We're too fear-based. We're too aggressive still. We're too greedy. We're too clingy as a race. And in a way, we haven't really evolved very much beyond, you know, 2,500 years ago in that sense. There were many more awakened beings at the time of the Buddha, because imagine being around an enlightened being. I mean, there was one city where about 250,000 people in the city, That's a quarter of a million people. Three quarters of those people were deeply, deeply realized. That means they're walking around in a state of compassion, love, kindness, generosity, openness, forgiveness. I mean, like, whoa. Look at people's faces, like you said, Daryl. Look at people's faces. And people will smile. You go to certain parts of this country, there'll be people more smiling in certain areas, more happy. You know, they did a study recently where the happiest countries to go to. Come up with like Finland, the Netherlands, Australia's in there. New Zealand gets a little, you know, attention in there. You got Norway in there. You know, I just talked to this guy who was in Finland. He was in Finland in the summer, right? It's like the sun's out, right? So everybody's going like this with their shirt. You know, and in Sweden, they don't even bother to keep the shirt on. Like, the sun comes out, they just throw their clothes off, and they're running around. Woo! You know, like, we can't handle that in Gainesville. Like, go down in front of the Hippodrome and go, I'm sunning! Get arrested. So it's, it just doesn't fit. And plus, we get too much sun for that to really be the activity. So, again, back to the very beginning, the apparent self, you see, if you believe there's a self and then you take spiritual teachings on, then the spiritual teachings say you need to find out actually that there isn't a self. Well, it's actually much simpler than that. Start from step one. If you're going to work on dissolving the self or the apparent self, look closely and see if there is an, if there is one there in the first place. And this is something that a lot of meditation teachings don't do. They say, go for the ride, you're going to find out what you get later on in the ride. I'm saying before you even get on the bus, can you have the good fortune to check out the most fundamental questions experientially before you even start? Because if that is possible, and it is, it may save you a lot of time of inadvertently playing out your conditioning right there within your meditative practice. It's like people who believe that the point of being awake or practicing meditation is to become unattached. You know who becomes unattached? Nobody. There's nobody walking around unattached. What that teaching means is that the phenomena of attaching, when discovered as not owned by anyone, there's no one doing that. It's a reflexive tendency. Impermanent. Selfless. And, when unrecognized, when viewed through the lens of ignorance, repeats itself habitually. Strangely, in the name of trying to secure life. Meanwhile, it's complicating it. You can see this so clearly. All you have to do is have somebody do something or nature do something to one of your things that you cherish. And all of a sudden, little stuff like pens missing can create such distress in people. Where's my pen? And then you like take their car. You ever see a human being have something large and so-called important to most people taken and they go, whoa. And they're not faking it. They go, whoa. I guess they really needed it. What are you, weird? You should feel bad. They stole your car. And when you get up to things like people taking people's wives and husbands, whoa. Whoa. I know a guy who was recently found his wife in a car downtown with somebody else, a man. And all of a sudden he like lost it. This is like a peaceful human being. He like lost it. He went flying up the car. He grabbed the guy, yanked him out of the car. He's ready to like punch him out. He was just completely in a rage. Why? Why don't you talk to your wife instead of him? Anger. That's mine. My wife. My car. My house. So it turns out, yes, the bank says you own the house and you pay the bills. The name's on the title, but that doesn't make it yours. Because nothing's yours. And the awake beings in the world know this. They know that there's nothing that they own. And this is a house they're renting. a way station. So this is a big topic, and our time is pretty much up. Anything else before we stop? I appreciate you jumping in and sharing your perceptions. Perceptions about the self suggest that it's here. And then we go further than the perception, we actually formulate a belief. I believe this. What spiritual practice does, what inquiry does, what good therapy does, is it opens that up for investigation so you can begin to see for yourself. The good news as a byproduct of that is that if there's suffering, if there's complications, they tend to diminish as the truth reveals itself. Truth about these matters reveals itself. The truth itself is what sets the human being free, not their efforts to be free. It's the truth itself that does it. So we should come back to this, I think, because I'm quite enthusiastic about this subject matter. And what you said, you know, and just sliding in the apparent self, because it is the big cheese, really. When the Buddha got into the teachings deep enough, he laid out so many different layers and parts of the teachings, and eventually it went to the core. It went right into the core, and what is it that really is at the root of the complication that human beings are experiencing? And he went right into the teachings of, in the Buddhist teachings language, it was called anatta. Anatta means no self. And the mind can't understand this because the mind is busy being a self. The brain is busy being itself. I am in here. But again, if you look in your brain and you try to find the I that you think you are, what you'll find is that all there ever is a thought that comes and goes. And when you start to see that space in there of no thought, simultaneously you begin to find peace. Simultaneously begin to find contentment, well-being, ease, just like you do in deep sleep. Only this time it's happening consciously. Check it out. But again, just to remember, if you'd like, the exercise I suggested, little troubles emerging, maybe a big troubles emerging if you can, instead of focusing on the trouble, what am I going to do, and thinking about it, and talking about it, just see if you can almost literally sit back, step back, see if you can just sense the awareness that sees the problem. If you feel that, most people, when they feel that, they may smile a little bit, even amidst the challenge or the stress, or they might go, they pause, slow down, stay there, maybe even close your eyes. You're not going to be able to locate awareness because it's not an object like thought, feeling, sensation. And yet it's here. It's not an object of knowledge. And then, after a minute or so, or more if you have the time, stay there, and come back and look at the problem again and see what's happened. This is analogous to, you've got problems in your life, you go to sleep, you don't do anything with them, you wake up in the morning and you have a different perspective. How did that happen? You didn't do diddly squat except fall asleep. Why? Because there's no self working on it. In fact, there's no self that ever could work on it. There's just an apparent self that thinks it's working on it. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Paul.
Nice to see you.